In December 1962, the Saturday Evening Post, a popular American weekly magazine, concluded,
"Apparently the American woman has all the rights she wants, and she has made her choice. Not business or politics, but marriage." One fine day, you're gonna want me for your
But the following year, 1963, the writer Betty Friedan blew the lid off such complacency by asserting that American women were living in a comfortable concentration camp.
The women who adjust as housewives, who grow up waiting to be just a housewife, are in as much danger as the millions who walk to their own death in the concentration camps. American women are not, of course, being readied for mass extermination, but they are suffering a slow death of mind and spirit.
Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, proved a runaway bestseller, helping galvanize a movement for women's rights that echoed many of the demands and methods of the Black protest. But as with civil rights, the women's movement soon fractured into rival groups, divided by class and also by race. Friedan presented her book as a cri de coeur from one of the millions of educated women imprisoned in suburban domesticity. Her raw material came from questionnaires and interviews with college-educated women of the 1940s. A Nebraskan mother of three, who had a PhD in anthropology, told Friedan about a typical morning.
I wash the dishes, rush the older children off to school, dash out in the yard to cultivate the chrysanthemums, run back in to make a phone call about a committee meeting, help the youngest child build a blockhouse, spend 15 minutes skimming the newspaper so I can be well informed, then scamper down to the washing machine where my thrice-weekly laundry includes enough clothes to keep a primitive village going for an entire year. By noon, I'm ready for a padded cell.
The post-war era wasn't quite as clear-cut as Friedan described. She played down evidence of women's public achievements and played up stories of claustrophobic domesticity. Nor was Friedan simply the frustrated middle-class housewife that she presented to the world. In the past, she'd been a labor journalist and closet communist. Early drafts of The Feminine Mystique were full of references to Marx and Engels, which she cut out to make her polemic more palatable to Cold War Americans. But when all is said and done, Friedan's caricature did capture the ethos of the prosperous, conservative 50s. Barely a third of college students in 1958 were female. Back in 1920, the figure had been nearly half. Friedan's book helped arouse thousands of American women and made her into an international celebrity. When pressures mounted to create a women's equivalent of the civil rights movement, she was the natural leader. Not just because of her fame, but because of her personality. As one colleague put it,
"She sweeps through meetings, telephone calls, dinners, and speeches with frantic bursts of energy as if each day might be her last. Everything is in motion, not just the words, which come so fast she seems to ignore the necessity of breathing. Her hands gesticulate, wave, flail. Her eyes are deep, dark, charged, and violent as her language."
The new movement, formed in October 1966, was called NOW, the National Organization for Women. Deliberately for women, not of women, it aimed to include men, just as the early civil rights movement had drawn in whites.
"The purpose of NOW is to take action to bring women into full participation in the mainstream of American society, exercising all privileges and responsibilities in equal partnership with men. There is no civil rights movement to speak for women as there has been for Negroes and other victims of discrimination. The National Organization for Women must begin to speak."
NOW and other similar organizations tended to be middle class and professional, campaigning for equal rights, especially in employment. The few women who did make it into top-ranked jobs found the cards stacked against them, then as now. Edith Grimm, who became the first female vice president of a leading Chicago department store, reckoned that the pay of the average woman executive was about half that of her male counterpart, even though she had to perform far better just to survive. According to Grimm,
a woman who is determined to play a game that is so fixed had better be prepared to look like a girl, act like a lady, think like a man, and work like a dog.
The campaign for pay equity and workplace rights was one strand of the new women's movement, equality with men. But there was another, more radical strand, campaigning not just for women's rights, but for women's liberation. Some of its roots lay in the civil rights movement, where white women volunteers in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC, were appalled at the sexism that lurked within the crusade against racism. Two of them, Mary King and Casey Hayden, circulated a manifesto.
Assumptions of male superiority are as widespread and deep-rooted and every much as crippling to the woman as the assumptions of white supremacy are to the Negro. Consider why it is in SNCC that women who are competent, qualified, and experienced are automatically assigned to the female jobs, such as typing, desk work, telephone work, filing, library work, cooking, and the assistant kind of administrative work, but rarely the executive kind. Maybe sometime in the future, the women in this movement will start the slow process of changing values and ideas so that all of us gradually come to understand that this is no more a man's world than it is a white world.
Many white women volunteers found themselves pressured to engage in interracial sex to prove their commitment to black-white equality. Stokely Carmichael, the black radical, asked,
"What is the position of women in SNCC?"
And then answered his own question.
"The position of women in SNCC is prone."
Many female radicals concluded that equal rights were not the remedy. Women had to liberate themselves totally from the patriarchal, male chauvinist assumptions that riddled even the liberal part of American society. A small but symbolic protest that hit the headlines was at the annual Miss America pageant in September 1968. Outside, radical feminists threw objects of female oppression, such as bras, curlers and high-heeled shoes, into a freedom trash can. They crowned a sheep Miss America and chanted,
"Ain't she sweet, making profits off her meat. Ain't she sweet, making profits off her meat."
But probably the biggest women's issue of the 60s was about gaining control of their own bodies. In April 1967, Time magazine's cover story was subtitled "Freedom from Fear."
The pill is a miraculous tablet that costs 1¼ cents to manufacture. A month's supply now sells for $2 retail. It is little more trouble to take on schedule than a daily vitamin. Yet in a mere 6 years, it has changed and liberated the sex and family life of a large and still growing segment of the U.S. population. Eventually, it promises to do the same for much of the world.
Women had practiced contraception for centuries, but the pill, based on synthetic hormones, was the first oral contraceptive. Used initially to treat menstrual disorders and infertility, it was marketed for birth control in 1960. At this time, many US states still had laws against contraception, but these were being struck down by the Supreme Court. By 1967, Time magazine estimated that of nearly 40 million American women currently capable of motherhood, 1/7 was using the pill.
Let it all hang out. Let it all hang out.
Some commentators saw this as a sign of sexual liberation. According to Betty Friedan,
in the mysterious way of history, there was this convergence of technology that occurred just as women were ready to explode into personhood.
As America's colleges went co-educational, the issue of sex on the campus became a popular topic for TV programs. which reported exchanges like this between a health official and a girl who came to get a prescription for the pill.
And how old are you?
21.
You have a particular man in mind?
Well, yes, I do.
Have you ever stopped to think that you might someday want to marry a man who holds virginity in a high regard?
Yes, but I'm not at all sure I want to marry a man like that.
But students on campus were only a small proportion of American females. Most users of the pill were probably married women, seeking to control the size of their families, or engaged couples who wanted premarital sex. Sociological surveys cast doubt on the idea that sexual habits had fundamentally changed in the 60s. According to Life magazine,
promiscuity was not invented by the current college generation, and the evidence indicates that it is no more common than it ever was. There has been much speculation that the pill has accelerated the willingness to engage in sex. The studies all refute this.
What had changed, these analysts argued, was not sexual behavior, but the willingness to talk about it, and to do so without shame or guilt. One doctor remarked,
"The presence of the pill does not make people decide to have sex. It is after they decide to have sex that they go get the pill."
Although women on the pill grabbed the headlines, what caused as much concern in the 1960s were those who weren't on it. Just as black women were suspicious of women's lib, so they proved more resistant to contraception. Middle-class blacks like Martin Luther King urged family planning as a way out of the ghetto, but radicals argued that this was a form of black genocide. Charles Greenlee, a black doctor in Pittsburgh, declared angrily,
"Our birth rate is the only thing we have. If we keep on producing, they are going to have to either kill us or grant us full citizenship."
Scary rumors swirled around the ghetto. A leader of the Planned Parenthood organization said,
"Many Negro women have told our workers there are two kinds of pills, one for white women and one for us, and the one for us causes sterilization."
But other black women disagreed. A 30-year-old mother in Cleveland said wearily,
"I've heard all this talk about genocide and such things. What the black power people want, well, that's their business, and I guess there's nothing wrong with it. But I've had 8 babies and 2 miscarriages. And honest to God, I just can't have no more. Birth control is my own salvation."
The debate had become intense because birth control was now being pushed not just by charities, but by the federal government. It would be a centerpiece of President Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty.